Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And we've got a great show for you this week. We'll be chatting with Dan Guido of Trail of Bits about the stoush between Apple and the US Department of Justice. Make sure you stay tuned for that. Also this week, we're chatting with Chris Thomas, aka Space Rogue. Chris works for Tenable Network Security, this week's sponsor. And he joins us in this week's podcast to talk about NIST's cybersecurity framework. Gartner says 30% of large organizations in the United States are already using it. So probably time for a bit of a primer. That is this week's sponsor interview with Chris Thomas. Thanks to Tenable Network Security. All that is coming up later, but first up, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, this glibc vulnerability affecting all types of Linux is causing a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth out there. And it's a bad bug.
Yeah, it's a hell of a bug, eh? We, we've seen bugs in the past in the resolving infrastructure. And that's what this is. It's in the code that parses DNS query responses, which, of course, I mean, everything parses DNS query responses. We've seen a bunch of bugs in this code in the past. I suppose the most recent one was the Qualys, ghost bug. I was about just coming up on a year ago. But, this kind of bug is really powerful because, of course, you can get DNS into all sorts of places. Straight up Stack Overflow in the parsing of long DNS responses. Although I say straight up, and clearly if it was straight up, we would see an exploit by now, which we haven't yet.
No, there's mitigating factors like ASLR and, stuff like that attackers have to get around. But I understand that, exploiting this is not impossible.
No. So, Google, the original research has been done concurrently by Google and Red Hat on this particular bug. And the Google researchers have said they do have a weaponized working exploit internally that they're not going to share. Apparently, they have at least shared it with Red Hat. And between the two of them, they agree that, yes, it is remotely exploitable, certainly on, modern RHEL, 6 and onwards on Red Hat. And, Debian and Ubuntu are saying that they were vulnerable to it as well. So, it is, according to Google, exploitable on modern platforms. This particular bit of code was introduced, I think, 2008, 2009. It takes a while for glibc to kind of percolate out. So, Linux is made in the last, 6-7 years at the very least are likely to have a vulnerable version of libc. But it's a bug that, you really want to patch regardless of whether or not, there is currently public exploit code.
Now, of course, this is in the bit of code that on the client side resolves domain names. What's interesting, though, is there's been a lot of confusion out there about whether or not you can exploit this via a conforming DNS request, right? So most of the reporting has said, you need to be in control of the resolver that's being queried by the client, or you need to be able to get in the middle of that and to be able to send oversized responses back at the client. But that is actually not true, we've discovered.
Yeah, so that's the simple case where you are the direct upstream resolver of a client that's resolving a name, and you can provide a malformed response. And the Google proof of concept code requires that. Their example delivers a straight up, bad, fairly big packet to the client and causes it to segfault just to demonstrate triggering of the bug. Whether or not you can get that malformed packet through resolver infrastructure and through the quite deep recursive resolver infrastructure that most organizations have, because very few people are going to let their internal talk directly out to the internet without going through some kind of intermediate DNS resolver. Now, of course, those resolvers vary widely in exactly how strict they are in the parsing. For example, bind versus, say, PowerDNS. PowerDNS has traditionally been a little bit more rigorous in how it validates the packet. So, the question of whether you could get a live exploit through that recursive resolver infrastructure is something we don't really know. Red Hat, the only statement we've got so far is that Red Hat have said in one of the original mailing list posts about this bug that their back of the envelope suggests that it should be possible to produce a packet that is that will do that.
I've actually got some more from Red Hat here, which says that a trusted resolver in a default protocol compliant configuration cannot mitigate this issue because potential exploits could involve syntactically well-formed DNS responses, right? So Red Hat say you can do this with, legit DNS responses that will be passed through multiple resolvers, which is really bad. But then we've got Dan Kaminsky quoted in other pieces saying that that's not possible. But I would certainly suggest that people should err on the side of caution with this one and maybe patchy things.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And if you can't patch this bug, then, you know, I guess you've kind of got other problems as well. I mean, if you can't you can't roll out a libc patch, then there's lots of things that have needed to have been patched in libc over the years. I mean, there was the classic Tavis linker bug. Presumably you haven't patched that one either if you can't deploy these kind of things. So yes, you should patch it. And I think, people should assume that this will be deliverable through the recursor infrastructure. And clearly it's not a straightforward bug. And I gather there is some secret source that is required to exploit it. We don't, maybe there's a related info leak or something that you can use to bypass the ASLR that we don't know about yet. But yeah, clearly it's not super straightforward, but yeah, I think everyone should just patch on the assumption that this is eventually going to be
catastrophic,
exploitable and eventually catastrophic through that mechanism. And I mean, the mitigations that we've seen elsewhere, things like, dropping DNS responses over a couple of K or over 512 bytes, even that's just not really an option. I mean, given that there are plenty of reasons to have DNS responses that big in the first place. I mean, IPv6, this bug was introduced adding IPv6 support. Big IPv6 responses, DNSSEC, filtering big packets will just break DNSSEC. I guess not that anyone uses that either, right? Just patch it, I think, is the advice that everyone should be listening to.
Well, funnily enough, it's been hanging around for about 7 years and was in the bug trackers from as far back as July last year. So a bit of a slow response on this one, but not in the case of the OpenWRT project. Those guys were onto this one.
Yeah, apparently someone linked me earlier on a bug report, a bug ticket from OpenWRT's bug tracker. They make an embedded Linux distribution for routers and firewalls and things. There's a bug filed against UClibc, the embedded libc that most of the embedded Linux devices use, certainly the small ones use, where they had exactly this bug. Overly large response to an AF unspec DNS query resulting in heap or stack corruption. And then this bug got fixed in UClibc something like six, seven years
you can
ago
see,
now.
You can see on the ticket, opened 6 years ago, closed 6 years ago. So yeah. There's that. Now, moving on to some news from the New York Times, and apparently Alex Gibney, who's, the famed US documentary maker, he made one of the WikiLeaks ones, We Steal Secrets, which was controversial in some circles, but whatever. He's an Academy Award-winning director, and he's turning his attentions to all things InfoSec again, to produce a documentary about the United States' plans to do very nasty cyber things to Iran if negotiations around its nuclear program failed. And it looks like this documentary is shaping up as a cracker, because there's all sorts of interesting news in this write-up about it.
Yeah, somehow he's managed to find some people to talk to him about the plans that the US government were making in the event that their negotiations with Iran went badly and they had to do something to carry out cyber attacks against all sorts of Iranian critical infrastructure, primarily focused on their nuclear enrichment outside Natanz, the original target of Stuxnet, but kind of following on from Stuxnet. So taking out the power grid if necessary and crippling presumably military radar systems, that kind of thing, so that if they did have to go into Iran, militarily, that they would have cyber support to do so, or maybe just, cyber only would be another option. But yeah, it's a really interesting insight into, a sort of the level of sophistication and, high-level strategic thinking of the U.S. in using cyber, the verb, for national...
Man, this is the most cyber interests I've ever heard come out of your mouth. That's a whole lot of cyber. There's a lot of cyber in this week's sponsor interview as well. We're just getting cybered out lately.
Yes, well, I mean, compared to killing people, I guess cyber, the verb, is less bad, right? I mean, that's the real takeaway from this kind of thing, that if the U.S. thought that they could do this without having to drop massive bunker-busting bombs, on underground facilities, killing all the people who work there, then maybe that is an improvement, in terms of humanely conducting geopolitics or something.
That's probably about a three-hour podcast for us to discuss and never arrive at any sort of resolution over, but there we go. It's a rabbit hole. We could be here all day. So you ever hear of these Bitcoin things called brain wallets? What a fabulous idea.
I actually hadn't heard of this, and this is such an awful idea, and I am not even slightly surprised that it ended badly.
This is what I love about Bitcoin, though, is it really is a great incentivizer of security research. The headline here on Ars Technica says, password cracking attacks on Bitcoin wallets net $103,000. Adam.
So apparently there is this crackheaded idea whereby if holding the private key to your Bitcoin wallet is too difficult for you for some reason, you can have a quote brain wallet unquote and I guess you can detect the sarcasm in my voice there, where apparently they will derive, you can derive the private key from a passphrase via some mechanism, and then just knowledge of the passphrase is enough to recover, to regenerate the private key, which you can then use to carry out
Bitcoin transactions. Fantastic idea. So it's like kind of like using PBKDF2 to generate a key from a password.
Exactly like that, except instead of using PBKDF2, which would be a smart thing, they use a single iteration of SHA-256.
Oh. Mm-hmm. you mean the hashing algorithm that's designed for error checking, not security? You mean that one?
Well, it could be worse. It could be CSE, right? But no, apparently there was a mechanism by which you could do this and then store, then the relationship between the derived private key and the public key that's visible in the blockchain was relatively straightforward. Anyway, someone very smartly went through the blockchain, harvested all the prior or the public key portions that relate to accounts that are generated in this mechanism, dictionary attacked them offline, and then stole all the money, which is exactly what you would expect to happen. And of course, yes, people were surprised to lose their $100,000 worth of bitcoins. And I gather now the quote brain wallet unquote operators have largely gone away because it's a stupid idea and you shouldn't have done it in the first place.
Brain wallet, it's right up there in the scale of bad ideas with a computer wallet, for example. It's actually taking the Bitcoin idea of a computer wallet and making it worse. So there you go. Here's a fun one, not technically a security story, but Adobe's Creative Cloud Suite for Mac has taken to arbitrarily just and randomly deleting user data. That's fun.
Yeah, apparently their update mechanism decides to delete its intermediate temporary files or something, and they assume that because they are .a Adobe, that they can just like delete the first directory in your home directory by alphabetical order, and it will be there, and it'll be totally fine, which is unfortunate if you happen to have some other important piece of data stored in your home directory that you would like to not have deleted, which apparently is exactly what's been going on. So yes, Adobe have pulled that update and they are endeavoring to fix it. And in the meantime, a bunch of people have lost important files. Apparently, like some of the Mac undo, like document recovery stuff, document revision stuff was being deleted, as that was in many cases the first file in people's folders and people's home directory. So yes, silly Adobe.
Oh, here's the fun story for the week, also courtesy of Ars Technica. Some teenagers in Baltimore in the United States stole a Jeep and then they paired their phones with the head unit so they could rock their hands free, and they got caught because of it. This is so funny.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah, so they broke into this guy's house. They stole his car keys, his Google Nest. Took photos of them, identifying one of the culprits. And then, three of the teenagers involved pair their phones with his Jeep. He gets it back from the shop eventually after the car gets returned, after it's been abandoned. And yeah, by combination of knowing the first identity and then social media things, figures out the identity of the other people involved based on the names of their phones. So yes, total OPSEC failure on behalf of, small-time car thieving joyriders in Baltimore.
Well, and even if they hadn't have been able to figure it out that way, you would think it would have stored the Bluetooth Mac, right? So that would have been enough as well. Like, just, I think the moral of the story is if you're riding around in a stolen car, don't Bluetooth pair to the head unit.
Yes, I think that is probably sane advice. Actually, hang on a second. Aren't there, like, with the cars that do, like, voice recognition for dialing, don't they upload the context database from the phone to the head end so that it can do the voice, like the speech recognition stuff?
You're asking the wrong guy. My cars are old.
Yeah, me too, right? My car's a piece of shit. But yeah, I wonder if that's the case in the Jeep one, because that would be useful to have a copy of the context database.
Yeah, you could just ring around and go, hey, one of your friends recently stole my car. Any idea who? That could work.
just ring mum, right? Or mom, in the case of an American one, and complain.
Moving on, and there's been, look, we had a similar story here in Australia. I think it was the Royal Melbourne Hospital had some systems go offline because of some ransomware. It's happened again in the United States where a hospital, they've had to delay patient care because their systems are all riddled with crypto locker stuff. And they've actually forked out something like $17,000 to get their computers back online. This is a real problem. And I would suggest that the people behind these attacks, look, you guys, you're already making money. I would think shaking down hospitals for ransom payments is probably not going to end well for you, because it's going to generate an awful lot of political will for politicians to prioritize you guys being in prison. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's the problem with this ransomware stuff, is that it is so effective at kind of getting small amounts of money at a large number of people that it gets into places where it's really just not I mean, I was going to say it's not cool, but I guess it's not cool in the first place, where it's just not, you know, not a thing that you want to happen. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, one of the things that troubles me, I guess, about the reporting is we've got two pieces that are in the news list people want to read, one from Ars Technica, one from The Register, describing this. And the Ars one really spins it as a targeted attack against hospitals and medical data, and The Register spins it in the way that sounds much more realistic to me, which is just, you know, it's randomly targeted. You know, if you look in your inbox these days, you will see plenty of things that are you know, trying to lure you to go somewhere, and most of those are going to drop CryptoLocker on you, or some, you know, variant of CryptoLocker-style malware. And it's just random. And I don't know whether, you know, it's probably not realistic to expect the Russian cyber criminals involved to actually figure out that they're targeting a hospital. Like, they're just targeting everybody and shaking down everybody. And, you know, the result of that is, yes, we are going to see some increased will to deal with it when they're shaking down police officers and healthcare. And
police departments, healthcare, schools, things like that. I just think tactically it's kind of a bad move. But this was the Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center in Los Angeles. So they just coughed it up. They coughed up $17,000. And when you think about it, that is going to be the cheapest way for them to go forward because you know, you ain't going to get your data back as easily or as cheaply using InfoSec professionals.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do, like phone Mandiant? Right? They're going to charge you that for the first meeting, let alone...
Yeah. I guess Kevin Mandia's expensive suits need to be paid for somehow, right? So this makes sense. Or they could get TrustWave in and then sue them for doing a shit job, because that seems to be an increasingly popular way to roll these days.
That is a way to make some money back out of it, actually, yeah.
Oh, now some news that kind of affects me a little bit, I guess. Ricochet, this is the instant messenger project I've been involved in for about 2 years. It's been audited by NCC Group, and it came through pretty good.
Yeah, now the report reads really well, actually. I had a, you know, both from a professional, you know, I write reports in the same style as that, and I thought it was quite a nicely written report, very good. But yeah, and also content-wise, you know, quite encouraging. I mean, there was a few recommendations they had about keeping the code quality up, but, you know, by and large, the report says, you know, that the code quality is pretty good. There was, you know, sort of one bug that could plausibly de-anonymize people that I think was already, I mean, I gather already relatively well understood.
That was already in the queue to fix.
It's a pretty good result for a project that, you know, really does have quite, I was going to say lofty, but, you know, quite specific and difficult goals in terms of preventing.
And it's written in C++, and they couldn't own it. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, no, it's a good report. Well, it's worth a read.
Yeah, so I'd suggest that, you know, I'd kind of encourage people now to go and play with Ricochet. I would suggest that it is, you know, about as safe as other messenger software, and probably substantially safer than quite a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly having a focus on the real problems, viz. Metadata, does differentiate it from a lot of other things. So, yeah, certainly worth people having to play with.
Go check it out at ricochet.im. And before we go, Adam, you sent me an incredibly complicated looking paper that I didn't have time to read, but it's about key extraction via electromagnetic attacks on PCs. Is this key extraction against what exactly? Like, where are you extracting the key from exactly? It's like a Tempest style key extraction attack.
Yeah, so this is a paper from Tel Aviv University in which they describe and implement Tempest-style electromagnetic side-channel attacks against general-purpose computers. In this case, a Lenovo laptop running Linux and running GNU-PG and libgcrypt. And then they put an antenna up near the laptop. They collect the electromagnetic emanations from it. And then from there are able to recover the private keys for the elliptic curve, Diffie-Hellman, using a chosen ciphertext attack. So they send a whole bunch of email to the machine that's running, you know, Thunderbird and Enigma, which automatically attempts to decrypt it. And then they, you know, look at the RF coming out of it and then figure out the key from there, which is pretty, pretty amazing stuff. I mean, certainly, you know, most people's understanding of Tempest is more focused on, you know, CRT, you know, classic display tubes and recovering the contents of the screen. And we've seen some other, you know, electromagnetic side channel stuff, but actually doing it against the CPU, you know, on a modern CPU that's going at multiple gigahertz is quite an interesting piece of work. And they've done it with, you know, relatively off-the-shelf, software-defined radio, I mean, an ETIS USRP software-defined radio and, you know, relatively simply available equipment, although the techniques are, as you say, quite sophisticated. When you read the paper, your head will start to hurt. There were some patches dropped into libgcrypt to address this specific example that they were using the other day. But yeah, it's a really interesting paper if you want to see what the, you know, the current state of the art of Tempest in the, you know, in the public domain is.
Yep, I've dropped a link to that in this week's show notes. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
No problem, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there. And, it's a good time to run a correction right now. In last week's news, Adam said that you would need a support contract with Cisco to get patches for that IKE vulnerability. That's actually not true. Customers can contact Cisco and get patches for vulnerabilities, even if they don't have a current support contract. So there you go. That mistake is on us. Now, onto the big story of the week. Apple has been ordered by the US courts to help the Department of Justice and the FBI unlock the iPhone 5C that was used by the San Bernardino gunman. This is the gunman who, along with his wife, went on a shooting rampage in California. Apparently, this was their way of expressing their support for those lovely people, the so-called Islamic State. Now, the assistance that they have been ordered to provide, that Apple has been ordered to provide, is very specific. DOJ wants Apple to come up with a modified version of iOS that disables the feature that auto-deletes content after a certain number of failed guesses. And they also want to disable lockouts after failed guesses, as in after 10 incorrect tries, you have to wait an hour before you can try again. So the idea is Apple can come up with this version, sign it with their key, then load it onto the device via DFU mode. From there, they have been ordered to offer access to the device so the FBI people can brute force the PIN code and unlock the device, hence exposing the content stored on it. The court has not demanded that Apple provide this crippled OS to the DOJ. So this looks very much like a one-shot deal, especially when you consider that Apple can easily nerf these types of attacks through an update to the next version of iOS. Well, Apple has refused the court order, is challenging the court order, and basically saying, no, we are not going to build a tool that will make brute forcing our operating system easier. You want us to create a backdoor and we won't do it, etc., etc. Dan Guido of Trail of Bits wrote a blog post about whether or not Apple can meet the technical demands the court has laid down, and he says, yes, Apple is technically capable of providing the DOJ with what they need. Dan joined me via Skype. I asked him what exactly the courts have asked Apple to do. Here he is.
So what the courts have asked Apple to do is to remove some of the security features that are present on the phone that make it more difficult to guess the passcode. And these features are pretty simple. You are probably familiar with them. If you guess 9 incorrect passwords, then you can only guess the 10th incorrect password after an hour-long wait. If you're guessing all these passcodes, there may be an auto-erase feature enabled where if you've hit that limit, the device will just wipe itself. And frustratingly enough, that auto-erase feature is not present on the user interface. So if you're there's no way for the FBI to actually tell that the phone has or does not have that feature turned on.
Yeah, they might just try their 10th passcode and then it says, F*** you, erasing, right?
Right, and this is why the FBI, to most people, looks like they've done nothing, because every single passcode they try that's incorrect might be one less that they can try in the future, because there may only be 10 tries total they can make. Mm. And then the last thing is that on any kind of smartphone or mobile device like this, you actually have to physically enter the passcode with your hand, right? And that is unlike most password cracking. People open up John the Ripper and they just let it go. But in this case, because it's inside this, you know, self-contained enclosure, they've got to pay some poor intern to sit there and hunch over and type in all these passcodes by hand. So what they've asked for is they've asked for a way to avoid all three of these restrictions. They want Apple to make a custom version of iOS that has no passcode delay, that won't wipe the hard drive after they make incorrect guesses, and that lets them make guesses from an external peripheral device like a laptop.
And then they want Apple to sign it so that they can load it onto the device via DFU, right?
That's correct.
So Apple's statement seems to suggest, though, that they're being asked to make modifications to iOS, the iOS that is used by everyone. And, you know, that's not the case, is it? So it's perhaps a little bit disingenuous on Apple's behalf?
Yeah, they are kind of blurring the lines a little bit here. What they're asking for is one particular firmware image that gets loaded onto one phone that uses the cryptography and the keys that are embedded in that phone to ensure it can only be read, that it can only work on that specific phone, and that it won't magically produce the passcode. All it does is it enables the FBI to guess.
Well, hang on, I got to stop you there, because as much as Apple is conflating the issue of creating a utility essentially for the FBI with weakening iOS for all of its users, the FBI is being a little bit sneaky by saying, oh, well, this will only ever be used on one device, because it does set a precedent, doesn't it? If they do it for this phone, why can't they do it for others?
It absolutely does. And core to the order and core to Apple's response is going to be claiming that it's a burdensome order. And it will be a little bit of upfront engineering work to create this custom version of iOS. But really where I see the burden coming from are the next 10,000 requests that other law enforcement agencies, not just in the US, but all over the world, make to Apple. They're going to end up having to build a new building and fill it with all kinds of workers to just hook up iPhones and set them up with this custom version so they can crack it.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the debate up until this point has been about, well, we don't want to see legislation that comes along that forces companies like Apple to have some sort of master key which can be used to unlock devices. As it turns out, there already is a master key. It's the signing key, and the FBI is just asking to use it. So that backdoor essentially has always been there.
Yeah, Apple has forced the FBI to come to their door because, as you mentioned, you know, you can't load your own software onto your own iPhone. The only person that can do that is Apple. So the only person that the FBI can ask to help them is Apple. And that's kind of how the situation has evolved. And anybody on the outside that was thinking about this could have predicted it.
Now, of course, there is an 80 millisecond delay time involved in passcode guesses, right? So this software update will bypass that. Is that right? Or will there still be an 80 millisecond delay and not the escalating delay to like an hour or whatever?
So the 80 millisecond delay is unavoidable. That is the computational time required for the CPU to process the attempt.
So they used some decent, intensive crypto, did they?
Yes, that's exactly it. So, you know, most of the development community is aware of like bcrypt and scrypt and these other things. What Apple has done is used a standard called pbkdf2, which is the password-based key derivation function, which just takes AES and uses it in a hashing mode to iterate through and over the passcode many, many thousands of times. And because it's being applied thousands of times over and over and over again, it ends up being slow overall. So on the iPhone, that means that every single passcode attempt takes 80 milliseconds, no matter what. What the custom version of iOS would change is that exponential back off. So every time you guess incorrectly, it artificially slows it down. So the FBI wants Apple to remove that artificial slowdown.
Yeah.
And they actually acknowledge this in the court order. In the court order, which is only two pages, if you haven't read it, you should go read it. The FBI says, you know, we want you to remove the software restrictions around the passcode, and we acknowledge that the hardware restrictions will remain.
So why can't you just suck the data off the device and brute it on a faster rig? Do you know what I mean? Like that would seem to, you know, be a logical thing. There's got to be a reason you can't do that, right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the most unique security features of the iPhone platform and the reason why the FBI has to even ask them in the first place. And that's because every single iPhone, whether it has a secure enclave or not, has a hardware key embedded into it at manufacture time. It's a 256-bit AES key. And when you actually log into your phone, when you type your passcode, it's not just your passcode that's decrypting and unlocking the phone. It's your passcode plus the hardware key. And the hardware key cannot be extracted from the phone. That means that any kind of password cracking that occurs needs to actually happen on the phone.
And Apple doesn't keep a record of these keys?
Well, they're producing hundreds of millions of these devices, probably at a wide variety of factories all over the place with a diverse supply chain. I think it would be a logistical nightmare to keep track of them, but it is also very easy to just avoid keeping them. And they've done this before. For instance,
there's no reason you would need to keep it, is there?
Right. And this is what got RSA in trouble, right? Many years ago when they got hacked by China and everybody, it turns out they were actually keeping a lot of the customer keys or a portion of the customer keys inside of their company, right?
That's what got them in trouble, right?
Right.
But now you mentioned the secure enclave just there. There has been confusion. You guys wrote a blog post that was regarded as the authoritative blog post, but you did actually make a mistake when it came to the secure enclave initially, didn't you? Because the initial post said that because the phone in question is a 5C, which is sort of the last one that didn't have this so-called secure enclave. That was from 5S and up. But there seemed to be a bit of confusion about whether or not these same techniques could be used against phones that have the secure enclave. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. So I did assume a little bit too much. You are 100% correct there. So yes, there was a lot of speculation. Well, this works against the 5C, but everything else has this bright, shiny new security feature called the Secure Enclave. And, I think it's supposed to protect against these kinds of attacks. And the common wisdom in the security community up until this morning has been that whenever you update the Secure Enclave, it would take all the secret keys that it's holding and it would wipe them. And that would be really safe, because that way, if Apple wanted to push some kind of trojaned or backdoored or crippled Secure Enclave firmware, then anything that it was protecting would just disappear. However, it doesn't work that way. There needs to be a little bit more flexibility on Apple's behalf, because maybe they need to support a new feature in Apple Pay, or maybe they want to increase the incorrect passcode back off. And actually, those things have happened in the past. The Secure Enclave has been updated, and user data has been preserved afterward. So that tells me, just purely by deductive reasoning, that actually firmware updates to the Secure Enclave do not interfere with the data it protects. And that means that Apple can issue firmware updates to that device the same way they can the iOS operating system. So this same general approach of replacing the software with a crippled version would work.
So the question becomes, what can Apple do about this?
Yeah, so that's absolutely correct. It's likely, in some private circles discussing this with other iOS security people, it's likely that Apple did not anticipate that they were going to receive an order of this nature and actually be forced to produce a customized version of iOS. This is something you kind of had to plan for years in advance, like when was the Secure Enclave chip fabricated, the designs finalized, and the security architecture of the iPhone hasn't really changed much since iOS 4. 5 years ago, they may not have had to be concerned with this threat, but today they certainly do. So I'm expecting that they make certain modifications in iOS 10 and with the iPhone 7 that help prevent these attacks. So what could those be, right? Allowing customers to have some kind of approval before new firmware updates are pushed into the Secure Enclave is probably going to be on the table.
So in other words, you would need to enter the passcode before it could enter DFU mode?
Before you enter DFU mode or before a new firmware update is loaded into the Secure Enclave. There may be a way to implement a feature like that. They may consider doing what I thought they were doing before, which is wiping access to the keys inside after it gets updated. There may be other options, like, for instance, why do they need to update the Secure Enclave at all? It's a very simple device. It runs L4, and there's a formally proven version of L4 called SEL4. They could just formally prove that there are no bugs and that it has the functionality that they want it to contain, and burn it into ROM.
You mean someone found a practical use for SEL4? That's amazing. I think we need to pop some corks here, Dan.
I know. Definitely a company with Apple's resources and deep pockets would be able to pursue the kind of effort required to formally prove not only the kernel that runs inside, but maybe some lightweight applications that run on it. And it would be a fantastic use of what is currently a research project. But they already have the same basic technology. They're running L4 already. So making that switch is definitely within the realm of possibility.
So who's going to win this one, do you reckon?
I think this is an uphill battle for Apple. I think that the requests that the FBI have made, they knew that Apple would be able to satisfy them. And it's going to be very difficult for Apple to argue that there's some reason that they cannot. Technically, as we've described in the blog post, it is possible for them to comply with the request. So they're likely going to have to argue this across multiple different boundaries. They're going to argue that it's impossible for them to comply with for certain reasons, that it's burdensome for other reasons, and that it's unconstitutional that the All Writs Act is being overly broadly interpreted and that the FBI doesn't actually have this power to make this request.
Well, we've stayed away from the legal aspects of this discussion because they're pretty weaselly. It looks like the DOJ is being pretty sneaky indeed. So I guess Apple is going to have to fight this in the courts and then get their best engineers to get working on creating an OS that they can't even unlock. I guess that's going to be the new target, right? Because there's there's nothing in this court order that says they can't do that, you know, for future updates.
Yep, I'm certain that there's a war room inside of Apple Legal right now that's trying to figure out how to respond to the court order, and there's another war room inside of Apple Engineering that's trying to figure out what the next version of iOS looks like. I don't think that it's very common for tech companies to consider themselves as the adversary to their customer, but now that this court order has been made public and actually issued and approved by a judge, it's clear that tech companies need to start thinking this way, that what happens if they turn evil and they start hacking into or crippling the security features of their own customers' devices and software.
What can I do to stop me?
Right. That's exactly what companies need to be asking themselves now. And this is really, like, it points to the larger end-to-end encryption debate as well. This is reducing companies' liability. It's reducing the amount of data and the amount of access they have to their clients' data and their clients' information. So it's all, like, for me, along the same trend line. You know, when you think about cloud hosting providers and the rest of these people, wouldn't it be great if they couldn't satisfy requests made of them for customer data because all of it was encrypted with keys they don't have? This is the same position that I think Apple's going to have to get themselves into, where you know, they're going to have to shrug their shoulders and say, like, look, you know, here's the data. It's all encrypted. That guy over there has the keys. Don't talk to me.
Yeah, but it gets complicated when you're talking about, you know, signing keys and whatnot. But as you say, you know, like, forcing passcode entry for things like firmware updates would be a pretty nifty solution to this. Is that realistic?
I think it is realistic. You know, likely the exact implementation of it, you know, I don't know exactly what it looks like. Nobody really knows how the Secure Enclave works. It's very difficult to get the firmware, like, very difficult is an understatement. It's nearly impossible to get the firmware off of it and to really investigate what's implemented on it, how it works, and what functionality that it has. So really, Apple's the only person, the only company in the position to answer, you know, what's possible and what's not. But from a high level, you would think that something like that could work.
All right, Dan Guido, thanks a lot for talking to us about all of this.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to do it.
That was Dan Guido there. Oh, and a fun thing here. If Apple makes you enter a passcode before you can reflash, that basically means your phone is bricked for all eternity if you forget your passcode. Such fun. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to them. And Tenable's very own Chris Thomas joins us now to discuss the NIST Cybersecurity Framework. The framework is only 2 years old, but already Tenable has seen a massive uptick in the number of organizations using it. So they've actually built a bunch of plugins and features for their Security Center product that are designed to automate and simplify the implementation of the NIST framework. And I think they're launching that at the RSA conference real soon. But Chris joined me to discuss the NIST framework generally. Its popularity seems to have taken everyone by surprise, including him.
We've seen more adoption than I thought was going to happen. I think we're something like 30% of industries or organizations now are using at least some aspects of the framework to sort of measure their security posture. I think when it first came out, I wasn't expecting that kind of adoption. So I'm pleasantly surprised to see that sort of take up by the industries.
So 30% of organizations, I mean, that's a lot. I'm very surprised about that. I mean, where did you get that actual number from? Was that self-claimed by NIST?
It's Gartner. It's a Gartner number. Used by 30% of all U.S. organizations, public and private, as a yardstick to measure their security posture. Gartner also anticipates that by 2020, it'll be 50%. Mm. So, I mean, it's a Gartner number, but it's good to see
how much stock you're putting into the analysts there, Chris.
It's a big number. I'm very surprised by it, especially, I mean, it's only been 2 years. And for something like this, usually adoption takes quite a bit longer. But I think that gives you an example of what the demand was for something like this, right?
But we've had things like that. I mean, there's the ISM here, there's your British standards, your international standards, and, you know, they've all sort of sprung from each other and whatnot. But I mean, in the US, are you saying that in the US there really wasn't a go-to framework like there has been in other markets?
there's no go-to. There are other frameworks here in the U.S. as well, but their adoption rates are much lower than 30%. And so I think that maybe speaks to the completeness of the NIST framework. And maybe I don't want to say ease of use because it's I've read it and it's not easy to follow. But it is fairly complete and it covers a lot of areas that I think maybe other frameworks miss.
So let's talk about the actual framework and you know, what's in it. What is in it? How's it broken down? Like, what's it good for? What's in there that makes sense? What's in there that's a bit daft? Because they've always got some daft stuff in them, these things.
They always got some daft stuff, and the daft stuff here is kind of minimal. It really covers the basics. I mean, it covers talking about things like inventorying your systems, which for you and me, we think, oh, that's a brain-dead, simple 101. Of course we're going to inventory our systems and our software and know what we have on our network. But really, a lot of people don't do that. And so the fact that they have this labeled out, step one, inventory.
It reminds me of a story. I mean, it was a long time ago, but someone found an old Linux box that had been sealed into a wall. It took them a while to track it down, but it had crazy uptime. And at the time, you know, all the Linux fanboys are like, man, this thing got sealed into a wall and it never went down and it was up for years. But yeah, it's true. You might indeed have a vulnerable box sealed into some drywall.
Well, and a lot of people look at inventory as what purchases have they made? Oh, that must be what's on our network. We got all the POs from finance, so now we know. Or they visit each office and they write down serial numbers and asset tags and say, okay, here's our inventory. We looked at all the software installed on these machines. And really, it needs to be automated. And I think the NIST framework spells that out. Like, you have to do an automated check of everything on your network all the time. Like, you can't just do a snapshot scan once a quarter and say, okay, this is what our inventory is. You really have to do it more real time, because otherwise you have what we call in-between scan blindness, right?
Yeah.
So because you have mobile devices that are in and out of your network all the time, people turn stuff off. If you're only doing once in a while scanning, you're missing too much stuff.
So what else is in this thing?
So, I mean, it talks about inventory. It talks about patching and the importance of patching. I mean, patching isn't going to save you, and people think that it will, but it's still an important thing to do, right? You still have to patch. And you have to patch all the time. You have to make sure your network is deployed properly so that you have proper segmentation, you have proper different technologies. You have to look at your user credentials. I mean, that's a big one that everybody forgets, is managing of user credentials and realizing that when somebody leaves your organization, you need to disable those credentials. Or when you have people changing, a bigger important thing that I see a lot is people changing roles inside an organization. And they're given new access to new stuff, but their old access is not taken away.
Yeah, identity management is one of those things, isn't it, that people just neglect, and especially with account deletion,
exactly.
Especially when someone's changing roles, as you say, right? Because if someone gets fired, okay, that's one thing, that's a priority. But if they move over into another department, like, people don't tend to revoke their access.
Right, exactly. And that's a big problem, because that's how attackers move laterally throughout a network. So they'll gain access to one set of credentials, and then that credentials has more access than it's supposed to. The attacker can then move around inside the network into places that they probably wouldn't have been able to had the credentials been properly managed.
Yeah.
So the NIST framework lists all these sorts of things in it and basically lists out best practices of what you should do in regards to these sort of basic things. And that's what it is. It's basic stuff. This isn't any sort of advanced rocket science network security stuff. This is basic 101 security stuff that we should all know how to do. I think the problem isn't that we don't know how to do it, is that we don't know how to measure it, right? We don't know how to organize it. Like, we have all this stuff that we need to do, and we're like, we're overwhelmed, and we're like, oh my God, I have to do all this stuff to secure my network. So the NIST framework, I think, helps people out by basically putting it in a list. It's sort of a checklist. And you can just go through it. Okay, I did that. I need to improve on this. I'm working on this. And I think maybe that's why you're seeing such a high adoption rate.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like the ISM. You know, it sounds a lot like the Information Security Manual, which is something that we had here, that we have here, that used to be the ACSI 33 standard. That's done by ASD, which is formerly the DSD, which is our equivalent of the NSA. There's a bit of, alphabet soup for you.
Right. A lot of these frameworks all have the same stuff in them. And it's just a matter of different organization. There's a lot of overlap. There are some minor differences between them, But the key, I think, and that illustrates the fact that a lot of this stuff is basic stuff.
Yeah, right? It is. I mean, the ISM, there's the top 30 things, the top 30 controls from ASD or whatever. And it's, like patch your stuff and like application whitelisting, AV, it's just all of that good stuff in a nice, easy to go list. Now, one thing that's interesting here, though, is that federal government departments are required to adhere to the ISM. Do you think this is something that'll happen in the United States? Is there already a standard for federal government departments that they must adhere to, or are they given autonomy in regard to how they secure their networks?
Well, I think it depends on whether it's a civilian or defense network, and there's some differences in there. But NIST right now is not a mandatory standard.
Is there another one? Is there any sort of mandatory standard for government departments? I mean, ignoring stuff that's secret and above, because even here, if it's protected, you've got to adhere, to these controls. If it's protected, these ones for secret, these ones for top secret.
No, as of right now, there is no overarching standard for all departments.
That's really interesting, right?
As witnessed by OPM.
Yeah.
Right, the Office of Personnel. Their network was a completely wide open, flat network, from what I understand. And so if there was a standard, they didn't follow it.
Do you foresee that this is going to become a mandatory standard for federal government? Because that would seem to me to be a pretty logical step.
Yeah, I wouldn't. It is a logical step, and it wouldn't surprise me if that happens. I think, to go back to the Gartner quote, they're predicting 50% adoption, public and private, by 2020. That's in 4 years. So that's not far away. That's pretty strong adoption rate. And I also see a lot of regulations that are being proposed at the U.S. at the national level that are not – they're conforming to the NIST framework. So you see it's sort of a template. So when the lawmakers go to make new laws, they kind of look at the framework and say, okay, this is already this. So we're going to make our law to fit inside this framework so it doesn't change anything.
Does the framework require you to use deliberately backdoored random number generators? Because it is from NIST, right?
Yeah, that is from NIST, but I think that's two different things. No, it's not. Those are deliberately backdoored random number generators are not required by this.
That's interesting. That's a surprise. I would have thought that would be the case. So now, of course, this is just one piece of what appears from the outside to be the federal government in the United States finally like giving a shit about InfoSec, because there have been things like this trickling out of Washington for a while. And of course, like last week or the week before, there was the big announcement about the national cyber strategy and whatever. What's your take on the direction the government's moving in over there? Because it does actually seem to be something that Obama, A, gives a shit about, and B, as a lame duck president, it's something the Republicans probably don't give too much of a shit about helping him on. Do you know what I mean? Because it's not a politically charged issue. Everyone agrees that keeping information safe from attackers is a good thing. Doesn't matter if you're Republican, doesn't matter if you're Democrat. So do you think, we're actually going to see some meaningful moves over the next year for the remainder of Obama's term?
I think we're going to see some attempts. I think it's also important to remember in the U.S., we had the SOPA and SIPA rules, right? Stop Online Privacy Act or whatever it was, that everybody in the U.S. got up in arms about, websites turned black. That caught a lot of lawmakers unprepared or by surprise in the U.S. when that negative reaction to the SOPA bill came out. And basically the entire internet turned to Congress and said, no, don't pass this law.
Yeah, so the Republicans didn't give a shit, but the internet did.
Right, the internet did. And I think what happened is a lot of lawmakers became a little gun-shy on anything, quote, cyber, right?
Yeah, right.
And say, okay, we're not going to do anything on cyber for a while because we don't want to have this kind of reaction again. And then it became sort of a mandate last year that they had to do something because of OPM, because of Target, because of Home Depot, because of all these large breaches. A lot of people were looking to government and said, hey, you need to do something. You need to protect us. And so that is one of the reasons I think why the CISA bill got rammed through Congress. That was the Cyber Information Sharing Act, to share threat information and create threat intelligence. So what's going to happen in the next year? One is I think we're going to see some movement on this NIST framework. And I think Obama is going to push for some more cyber stuff, all right, for lack of a better term. What form that's going to take, whether it's going to be a presidential directive, whether or not there'll actually be a new bill in Congress. There's also movement on reforming some of the old bills. There's the Electronic Communication Privacy Act, which is currently being marked up, if you will, to try to be passed in the current session. So there is a lot of cyber activity, if you will, in Congress right now. How much of that is actually going to come to fruition, I don't know yet.
And can we expect a new draft of the NIST standard anytime soon?
Well, they do have an open call for comment or call for information right now. They've extended the deadline for comments till February 23rd. And they're trying to make sure that the NIST framework stays relevant. Like you mentioned, it's already 2 years old. And so they want to update the current framework. And they also want to try to make it somehow to be self-regulating, if you will, so that it maintains itself with as technology and security improvements improve. So that comment period is open until the 23rd, and hopefully they get some good comments and can and redesign or add to the framework as it in the near future.
All right. Well, Space Rogue, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about the NIST framework for the cyber. Man, we had a lot of cyber in this interview.
I know. I apologize.
Look, it's the way it is these days. All right. Thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again in 2016.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, Space Rogue Thomas there, and that is it for this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. Big thanks to this week's sponsor, Tenable Network Security. Do check them out at tenable.com. I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.